This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Say, listen, I don't want you to lose track of where the radio is in your life, but would you do me a favor just right now for just a couple of seconds? The closest window that you have nearby, if you're listening in the car, you've got plenty of windows around you, and if you're listening at home or in an office, wherever you are on the planet, if you can hear this request, take a look outside. And if a building isn't blocking your view, you know what you're looking at? You're looking at nature. Yeah. And some of you really lucky folks get a chance to look and say, wow, isn't that beautiful? Barbara Mahaney took a look some time ago, and she never stopped looking. And she wrote about it in the Book of Nature. And Barbara, I am truly grateful for this beautiful tribute to the things that often go unnoticed in our days because we're so doggone busy. By the way, this is the same Barbara Mahaney, the author of the Book of Nature, that you may have read it in the Chicago Tribune. We have so many Chicago people here in Phoenix. And all you have to do is say, Harry Carey, Barbara, and everybody opens the door and says, wait a minute, is it time for the Cubs?
Oh, hello, dear Pat. It's great to be here.
And I missed out on talking to you about the original book, Slowing Time, subtitled, I believe, Seeing the Sacred Outside Your Kitchen Door. Is that right?
That's right. That's correct. That was my first book in 2014.
Yes. And you do think of nature in sacred terms, don't you?
I do. I mean, I see it for its beauty, but I see beyond the beauty into the depths and wonders of it and find myself stirred by it, breaking out in goosebumps from it, mm-hmm. and slack-jawed from it sometimes. And I feel small against the vastness of it, and I find it to be just a magnificent channel to God, to the sacred, to divine. And I'm not the only one. Millennia of people have been looking to the stars and listening to the seas and watching the wind blow through prairie grasses and understanding that the great hand of the great animator, the great intelligence, God, was at work.
And your subtitle, The Book of Nature, also speaks to that. You say the astonishing beauty of God's first sacred text is the Book of Nature. And I was thinking about that this morning, having read your book over the last couple of days. As my regular visitor, my hummingbird friend, yes, even in 110 degrees here in Phoenix, my hummingbird friend stopped by the kitchen window, as he does so often when I'm making coffee. And so from one Irish Catholic to another, I'm interested in how another Irish Catholic came to this Book of Nature Jewishly.
Well, there's a story. As an Irish Catholic, we're big on stories, aren't we? So here's a story. So I was on the radio, because this was back in the days before podcasts. It wasn't that long ago, but podcasts are relatively new. So I was talking to Rabbi Rami Shapiro about my very first book, Slowing Time, which you mentioned, which came out in 2014. And Rami Shapiro was this deeply soulful rabbi who had written half the prayers and poems in the prayer book of the synagogue I go to, because I'm an Irish Catholic, but I've been married for 32 years to a wonderful Jewish man, and we've embraced both religions. So I was on this radio show talking to Rami, and Rami said, in an offhanded way, deep in the conversation, He said, slowing time reads like midrash to the book of nature. And as I write in this book, the book of nature, in the foreword, I was pretty excited to have midrash pinned to my writing. As you know, a lifelong Irish Catholic, nobody had ever told me that my writing was midrashic, which is ancient rabbinic commentary. So I was excited by that, but I was wholly stopped by this notion that there was something called the book of nature. And I could tell the way he said it, that this was capital B, O, capital N, nature. And I thought, now, wait a minute, how could I, who grew up, you know, in the woods, sloshing in the creek, with a mother who took more home movies of the birds in the trees than her five little chicklets, you know, how could I not know about the book of nature? So I got off the radio show and I did what any curious person in the 21st century does. I Googled the book of nature to see what was this thing I'd been missing. And sure enough, I discovered it was this ancient theology subscribed to by Western and Eastern religions the world over. And it had been prominent in Christianity, but somehow over the decades, as we moved through the space age, the atomic age, the digital age, we kind of shoved it off to the side. And the more I read about it, the more it matched my own experience of nature and this sense of encounter with the divine. And so I deep dove into it, and I'm still deep diving. And it turned into this book, The Book of Nature.
You're a Chicago resident now, or at least near Chicago. Where exactly did you grow up as that little girl in the woods?
The little girl in the woods, we bounced around the Midwest for a while, but most of my woods life was actually in a Chicago suburb called Deerfield.
Oh, yeah.
But it was back in the day before subdivisions, and there weren't many subdivisions. And I come by my love of nature naturally, because my mom says she looked at like five houses in a day and she picked the house with the most oak trees in the yard. So I grew up under those oak trees. My bedroom window looked out into those oak trees, and there was a gurgling creek across the street that led to a pond that was surrounded by woods. And that was where I played day in and day out, because those were the days when, you know, mom let you out in the morning, and when the dinner bell rang at 6, you came home for dinner, and then you went back out until, you know, the stars and the mosquitoes got too thick and you had to come home again.
But was that little girl as filled with wonder about nature as the adult Barbara is today?
Absolutely. I mean, it was the font of all my imagination. I spent so many hours in the woods playing, you know, pretending I lived in the little house on the prairie, and the honeysuckle berries were my, you know, my stews, and acorns and the logs were my furniture. And it was, you know, I mean, I was one of those kids reaching into the creek and like with a stick and trying to pick up the crawfish and screaming and getting wet and getting dirty. And my mom didn't mind any of it because she loved where we were playing. But yes, I was in love with it. And for me, it truly was the font of stories. I remember falling asleep at night and with my head on my pillow, and I would just imagine myself out. I had a little, it was like my playhouse, but it was a little old-fashioned log cabin that my parents had tucked into a woodsy corner of our backyard. And I mean, I would just go to sleep at night imagining, you know, the rooms in that house. And I don't know back when I was a little girl if I connected nature to the sacred. I was a deeply religious little kid. But I don't think that I made that connection until later. And I think that's why once I, you know, Googled the book of nature and discovered that it was this theology And it just opened the door for me to something that I guess I had always been seeing, but hadn't recognized what I was seeing, if you understand what
sure.
I mean.
Sure. I can't think of a better way to introduce the mood of the book that we're talking about with its author, Barbara Mahaney, The Book of Nature. Can't think of a better way than to introduce our audience on every part of the planet that we share all of these natural wonders with whom we share them, than to tell them that at the end of every segment of the book, there's a little compilation of some interesting pieces of information, most of them absolutely amazing. They're all called Litanies of Astonishments. So the Litany of Astonishment at the end of different segments offers you little tidbits, canapes, hors d'oeuvres of information about nature. And I'm going to ask you now, I'll probably repeat this through the hour, I'm going to ask you now, first of all, though, to give us one of the litanies of astonishments that I treasured about the monarch butterfly. Tell our audience about what is astonishing about these creatures.
What's astonishing about these creatures, among the many, many things, is they migrate. Their path of migration is the longest of any butterfly species, perhaps any species. I'm looking quickly to find it so I can read it to you. But what they do is they fly every single year back to the same tree. If they're monarch butterflies from east of the Rockies, they fly to Mexico. If they're monarch butterflies from west of the Rockies, they fly to eucalyptus groves along the Pacific coast. And each generation flies back to the tree of the previous generation.
See, that's, yes, that's
my mind.
Absolutely remarkable. Back to the tree of its origin.
Back to three. And not only that, so most of the monarchs of the year live, you know, a number of weeks. But there's a generation. I mean, how amazing is this? There's a generation called the Methuselah generation. And the Methuselah generation, named after the character in the Bible who was the oldest ever man on record. I think he was 959, according to the Bible, 959 years old. The Methuselah generation of monarchs lives long enough so that they can make that trek in one fell swoop without, you know, without dying along the way. And I wish I could find it in the book to be able to read it to you right now and make sure I'm not forgetting anything.
No, Barbara, no, truly, all I wanted you to do is from memory. You don't have to read the passages. No, I just wanted you to tell with your love and with your passion and the freshness of those memories that live with you and the Book of Nature. I just wanted you to tell people about that, exactly what you did, the remarkable journey of the monarch butterfly. And by the way, I'm glad that you mentioned my classmate, Methuselah. I'm often compared with him. He was a terrific guy.
Wait, and then can I just add one thing?
Sure.
Because here's where it gets into poetry. Like, the poetry of creation is just so magnificent. So I hope all of you who are listening are at least familiar with the monarch butterfly. And the monarch butterfly wing I liken to a stained glass window. It's an orange and black, almost like a stained glass. And what's really, really, really beautiful is that these monarchs fly in a cloud. They fly together in this flock of monarch butterflies. So just close your eyes and imagine for a minute this beautiful orange and black cloud of stained glass windows with its wings just fluttering through the air for miles upon miles upon miles. And I think this is also one of the astonishments of wonder. The monarch butterflies don't need to stop because they drink the mist that rises in the morning dew, from the morning dew into the atmosphere. And so their thirst is quenched. They don't have to stop. Sometimes they stop. But isn't that a beautiful thing? Can you just imagine this fluttering orange and black stained glass window cloud crossing the continent?
And here are your excitement. Here are your excitement in describing this is just as moving to me as when I read about it in the Book of Nature. By the way, we'll have at least another couple of astonishments coming up, too. But I want to get to something that needs attention, because in the book, you counsel folks that they would be better off if they paid attention. In fact, sometimes as I was reading this, I felt like it was Sister Mary Elliott from school shouting at me to pay attention and stop talking to the person in the seat next to me. Well, you're saying pay attention to what's going on in nature, but is nature now slipping by unnoticed to all too many people?
I think sadly that is yes, because we live in this digital age that is all but hardwiring our noses and our glances to the little rectangular shiny box in front of us. And we're not getting lost in the woods anymore. And we're looking down at our screen instead of up at the stars. And I've seen people on cell phones in the woods. And it's an urgent call to attention, because sure, nature sometimes clangs us over the head when the thunder's rumbling and the lightning is striking. We usually look up, I hope, maybe out the window, but most of nature operates in quietude. And it demands our attention. And putting the cacophonies on hold and crouching down low and seeing what's in front of us. The thing is, once we set the intention to pay attention, it's not too hard. I mean, it's right there. And I make the point in the book that we needn't travel to exotic places to encounter the wonders and the awes of creation. It's the simple, simple beauties right out our windows. I mean, you know, in my backyard, it's the scarlet red cardinal. And this summer, it's the Jenny Wren who's warbling at, you know, the highest pitches nonstop. And there's beauty and lessons to be drawn crouching down low and watching a fern unfurl its fronds. I mean, it's just endless, endless, endless. The moon at night. The moon strikes a lot of us really deeply. But how often are we looking up and noticing the phase of the moon?
Perhaps it is my heritage, my Irish origins, that allows me to say without question, I have never been pessimistic about anything that I can remember anyway. And yet sometimes I really wonder if nature can return from the industrial pollutants that are now an accepted daily part of our lives. And yet I went right back to optimism when I got to your chapter about something that we're all close to and aware of, in that we don't ever want it to happen again, Hiroshima. And what you wrote about Hiroshima really topped the experience that I had in interviewing a survivor who was in his basement When the blast took place, I'll never forget, it was years and years ago that I talked to this man. He became the mayor of Hiroshima later on. But tell the audience why something like Hiroshima could possibly create any level of optimism on my part.
It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story. After the atomic bombs were dropped in Hiroshima, and it was a landscape of annihilation, and scientists predicted that it would be barren, it would be without life for at least 5 years. Lo and behold, what happened was the bricks of the buildings, of many of the buildings in the houses, and probably cobblestones of streets, had been put together from mud up in the mountain that had been drawn from the mountains. And that inside that mud had been collected just seeds, you know, the wildflower seeds that had blown, of course, on a mountainside, of course, they're blowing. And so unbelievably and blessedly, it was the cataclysmic blast of that atomic, of those atomic bombs that just erupted these dormant seed pods that were buried inside these bricks. And within weeks or months, wildflowers arose in Hiroshima. Canna lilies and bluettes. And I go through the whole litany, and all of it, I drew all of that from John Hersey's amazing classic story, Hiroshima, that was published in a 1945 issue of The New Yorker. Just a classic, classic book, which an article that was made into published as a book. But I mean, that's just a stunningly beautiful story. And it's another version of a story like that was after the great fires of London. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember exactly what year, but similarly, you know, this fire swept through London, and then the next spring, all these mustard seeds had bloomed. And so out of the ravages of devastation blooms life again. And there's a metaphor. And with so many, you know, Jesus spoke in so many parables, and nature speaks to us in so many parables. And so that's why this idea of reading the book of nature, it's calling for a level of reading, you know, an interactive, really probing sense of reading, not just kind of a casual glancing at nature, but really pausing to consider it and pay attention to the lessons it's teaching. And Hiroshima clearly was a profound and beautiful resurrective story.
I'm glad you told it, too, in the Book of Nature. We're talking to Barbara Mahaney. And by the way, I'm also taken with the fact that some of the sins that we commit, often unintentionally, but some of the sins that we commit against nature are not as horrific as the inhumanity of war. Sometimes it's what we call progress. Like the story you tell about your hometown in a place that I've always loved visiting, Chicago, and the lights of that remarkable skyline that you have along Lake Michigan, Lakeshore Drive, and all of those marvelous high-rise buildings, and the lights and the relationship of flying birds with those buildings and those lights. Tell our God Show people about what you've written about that.
Oh, that's another sad irony. All these, and I remember, so I was, we haven't talked about this, but I was a writer at the Chicago Tribune for almost 30 years before I left to start writing books. And one of the later stories I did at the Tribune was I went out with a squad of volunteers who go out, it's the bird collision, I forget exactly what their name is, but these giant, sparkling, glimmering glass towers that edge Lake Michigan's shoreline, which happens to be one of the great flyways for migrating songbirds from Canada down to wherever, you know, in Central America or South America, wherever they spend their winters, because they're smarter than some of us who stay here for the winter. Those glimmering glass towers that often will have lobbies filled with trees are a terrible, deadly decoy to the birds who don't see, who can't tell that glass is glass. Nobody ever gave them a book that said, this is glass, you can see through it. So they fly right into the glass walls and they crash to the ground. So I went out with this crew of blessed volunteers who walk the streets of Chicago's Loop and the lakefront in the morning, especially during migration season in the spring and in the fall. And they pick up birds that are injured or sadly already dead. And the injured ones, they ferry to a car that then drives them to a rehabilitation center. But thousands upon thousands of birds die crashing into shiny glass skyscraper lobbies in the morning. The light attracts them. They see the leaves of the lobby trees and they think, oh, great, here's a good place to stop for a drink on my way to Central America. And then, boom, they break their necks.
Well, then let's tell a positive bird story.
Okay.
We'll go back to Litanies of Astonishments. And that sounds like Paul Harvey doing an introduction to one of his rest of the stories. The Litany of Astonishment that you wrote, and that I've just chosen selectively, the reality of baby birds in nests developing a sense of guidance.
Absolutely. There's so many baby bird wonders because, I mean, imagine how short their little learning spans are. They've got to pack it in. But the baby birds, this is truly an astonishment. The baby birds, while they're in the nest, are looking up into the night sky and they're memorizing the constellations in the night sky so they know where Polaris or the North Star is, and they orient themselves so that they can take to the skies when it's time for spring or fall, for fall. These are baby birds, so they're not going to be migrating in the spring. These baby birds born in the spring or the early summer are migrating in the fall. And some species of birds, the mama and the papa bird take off before the baby takes to the sky. I mean, the baby is by then a fledgling, but there are first generation birds who will then, you know, take to the skies all on their own because when they were in the nest, they were memorizing the night skies. And I'm not making this stuff up. All of my astonishments come from scientific research. You know, God bless the scientists who are somehow discerning that baby birds, you know, are doing this. But science tells us that, in fact, baby birds in the nest are looking up at the night sky and they are finding their way. They're imprinting the map in their little bird brain and they will be able to find their way without getting lost.
Oh, boy, are we grateful that Barbara Mahaney looked up at the night sky when she was growing up outside of Chicago and then eventually wound up writing the Book of Nature. Do I sound like I'm fawning? Yeah, probably, because after all of the shows and all of the books, it's kind of surprising to be so romantically deeply moved by the stories that are told. And this is really a storybook too. I was just thinking about the fact that you have written as eloquently as you have about the birds and the beasts and the trees and all of these things that so many of us take for granted. What about your kids? Will and Teddy, the two boys, they grew up with a mom like you. Did they also grow up with anything like your love of nature?
You know, it's so funny. You don't know for a while what's going to stick, right?
Yeah.
I do. The stories aren't in this book. Some of the stories are in Slowing Time. Some of the stories are in my second book, which was called Mother Prayer. But my little one, Teddy, is the one with whom I took moonwalks. And we would bundle up for a moonwalk, and he would, as I write, I think I mentioned it in this book, he would, you know, bring along pockets full of animal crackers, and he would bring big plastic lightsabers, because heaven only knows, when you're going on a moonwalk, you might need a lightsaber. So we would go out and we would walk and just study the moon, and we would, you know, pull on our boots and go for really quiet walks when the first snow fell and it was supremely quiet outside. He became really enchanted with binoculars as a 5-year-old and taught himself how to, I was trying to teach him how to use binoculars to look out the window at a cardinal. And it's an essay that's dear to my heart. It's called Teaching to See, and it's about allegedly teaching a child to use binoculars, but in fact, I was teaching him at 5 years old to see far beyond just the red feathers of the bird. But I was trying to teach him how to see in the way that leads you to seeing the sacred.
How old is Teddy now? You've got Will and Teddy are 8 years apart, did I read?
They're 8 years apart. Will just turned 30, and Teddy today is, he's still 21. He'll be 22 in a few weeks, but he's 21 today.
Well, I'll tell you what, you do me a big favor if you told Teddy the next time you chatted that you were talking to a guy who, even as an adult, many times over, an adult, that I delight in going out. We happen to live on a golf course here in Phoenix, and so the golf course and the water and the expanse of the fairways will attract all kinds of bird life. But we attract, for some reason or other, to Phoenix, Arizona, right in the middle of a city, Canadian geese. And I keep looking at them saying, you know, there's really a better time to visit us than in the middle of summer, because they're Canadian geese. And wouldn't you be more comfortable around Calgary, Montreal, Toronto, or that vast forest land? No, they have Canadian geese on this golf course in numbers that occasionally, when they come in with a large flock or two, will cover the green around a hole. I mean, you can't play golf there because there's dozens and dozens of big, huge Canadian geese. And there's nothing that's more fun for me than to take breadcrumbs and bird feed out. And and to enjoy their company and to watch a family, this just happened today, watch a family where dad stands at attention and watches while the rest of the family is picking up the crumbs and the seeds. And he's just there, ever alert, watching this. I do whisper to them, by the way, how cool Canada is this time of year. It's 110 now here.
Here's your airplane ticket. Here's your passport. Get up there.
But they stay. But they stay. I have no idea where they go the rest of the year. But
they like your water, I guess. Matt. I don't know.
Anyway, but how much fun that is. Teddy and I have shared respect for feeding the birds. Who on earth, telling the stories that you've told, enriches us, causes me as a sports fan to think back when the U.S. hockey team was playing Russia in that remarkable upset that we all know, even if we're not hockey fans, and that announcer saying, "Do you believe in miracles?"
Yeah.
And in reading your book, I was reminded about the miraculous nature of so many of these things. But how much better some people must do than we do in the United States with all of our industry and all of our busyness. Is there, in your research, some countries, some cultures, some people that are more respectful of nature than we are?
I mean, I think it's baked into the DNA of all the Celtic peoples.
Mm.
You know, I don't know. I'm sure there are plenty of parts of, you know, Ireland and Scotland and Wales where it's crazy, crazy busy. And people are just as distracted as we are. But maybe it's more palpably near the surface for some people. And in some, I mean, even in the rural United States, I mean, there are people who are clearly attuned to the sacred of all creation, even if they don't call it religion. But I do think people who probably live in less sparsely populated places in parts of the world, maybe where the digital world hasn't quite caught up, who in fact, whose lives are far more knowingly tied to the rhythms of heaven and earth. I think we've distanced ourselves from our dependence on those rhythms, but those rhythms are at the heart of our existence, of our survival. You know, it's what comes from the ground because something has fallen from the heavens. And so the cycle repeats and repeats, and the globe turns and turns, and one season unfolds into the next and the next. And so the rhythms are there, whether we pay attention or not. And I do think that there are blessed places throughout the world that are far more connected to that knowingness than we sadly are. We have to make a real effort. And I think there are some people for whom it's never drifted far away.
Several times in the book, you mention the respect for nature and the coexistence with nature of many African cultures.
Mm-hmm. African cultures, ancient Israelites, indigenous peoples in the United States, throughout Eastern religion, they've just never moved far from that sacred knowing of the, you know, the powers that thrum from the earth and the heavens, and how we are at the mercy of all of those forces.
I'm glad you mentioned the indigenous people, because I'm speaking to you from Phoenix, Arizona, surrounded by tribal lands and mm-hmm. and multiple tribes. And you use those parallels in the book of nature, and how many of the tribes still, in spite of our inattention to their needs, mm-hmm. How they still find a daily participatory relationship with nature.
Absolutely. I mean, it's alive. It's alive in their stories, and their stories are so beautiful, and we're the ones who should be sitting at their feet, listening to them, absorbing their wisdoms, because, you know, we might have stolen something away from them, but they clung desperately to the truths as they know them. And I think it's so important to read the authors and poets who come from indigenous traditions, whose stories can't help but move us. And so we might not have people at whose feet we can sit at to learn those stories, but we can all read their writings. And as I've discussed or talked about this book in the months since it came out, and even in the writing of it, in the book itself, I talk about how writing this book was really, before it was an exercise in writing, it was an exercise in deep, deep, deep reading. And I read broadly and deeply. And as a journalist, I culled just the wisdom of all those books and wove it into this text that is just, I'm deeply dependent on all the sages and seers who came before me and who, in effect, by reading them taught me to see at a deeper and a deeper level. And so with the Indigenous peoples and their stories that are so beautiful and evocative, in listening to someone's story, maybe to someone's story about the sacredness of a particular tree or the sacredness of thunder and lightning playing together in the heavens, we can just kind of peel back the layers and begin to glimpse some of the beauties that might not have come to us naturally and through our ethnic traditions, but they're available for all of us to tap into.
Well, and the material is available too in the book, because you close with a number of pages devoted to a bookshelf of wonder.
Yeah, I love that part of the book because, I mean, I love reading. I love words. I've been in love with words my whole life. And for a while at the Tribune, after I officially left the Tribune, I was still reviewing books for the Tribune book section while they had one. They don't have as much of one anymore. But I had a monthly column called Books for the Soul. So I was writing, you know, shortish book reviews of books that I determined books for the soul every month for years, for I think it was almost 10 years. And so I'm very much practiced in the habit of, you know, it's almost like sitting on a bench with a best friend saying, here's the book to read. And so after piling my office with some 200 books, I just felt compelled to say, hey, 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 if you're enchanted by the stars, here's the book about stars you really want to read. Like, let me save you some time and just point you to the most poetic, the most in-depth, the most beautiful books you can read on any of these subjects. So the Bookshelf of Wonder contains kind of the 12 volumes, the 12 titles that I most deeply treasure when it comes to the subject of nature and the sacred in nature. And then I divided it into each of the 12 essays that I write, birds, woods, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I point you to the best books on those particular subjects too. So it was a really, really fun kind of add-on to the book. But as someone who loves to read and loves to be told, oh, here's a book to read, I had a marvelous time befriending those would-be readers and saying, here, sit down next to me and let me show you the books I really think you would love.
Rarely do I interview an author that writes a book that sells so many other people's books. But I congratulate you for making all of that information available to us. And there's an emphasis also that I want to make, because so many times society tends to insist that we fall into an us and them, good guy, bad guy, we're angelic and they're evil. I don't think that most people who are involved with unnecessary damage to the environment, I don't think they're evil. I think many times they do so unknowingly. They do so because they think that the effect will not be as dangerous to them or their families or mankind in general. And it turns out that so many times they're wrong. We wind up polluting the land and our foods and our bodies. So I'm asking you now, as somebody who clearly cares that much, you're shouting with a melodic voice, but still shouting, Barbara, at the world. But I wonder, if at night, when you look out the window at those trees in Illinois, do you wonder if anybody's listening?
I know that people are listening. I've always said one of the things I love most about writing a book, I love conversation. I love one-on-one conversation, especially because it tends to get deeper, like this conversation we're having. And what I've discovered in writing books is that it's the beginning of a conversation. And I get such beautiful emails and letters and people I run into who just tell me over and over and over how this book resonates for them, because they are people who, in the quiet of their own soul, do respond at a really deep level to what they see and feel and hear and sense in all of creation. And maybe reading this book and then seeing it through this lens, this spiritual lens that illuminates not just the beauty and the wonder of nature, but the divine animation behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know that there are untold scores of humans on this planet right now who care deeply about a baby bird fallen, who care deeply about a tree that's felled. And, you know, the most important message of this book probably is that I set it up the way I set it up. I saved the lamentations for the Book of Nature till the very last chapter because I didn't want to clonk people over the head and say, stop poisoning the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted first to set up, to open the door to this wonder and open the door to this idea that nature isn't just beautiful nature or powerful nature or majestic nature, but that nature is this uncanny channel to the divine, to the sacred, to the God who animates all of us and everywhere, always. And if you start to understand that to desecrate any aspect of creation, whether it's bulldozing a meadow or poisoning a lake or whatever it is, we're not just ruining a sacred natural resource, we're cutting ourselves off from a channel to God. And so my hope is that in illuminating, accentuating that cord of connection, that God comes to us through creation, we might pay more attention and feel more of a sense of urgency to not just save the earth because it's a natural resource, but to save it because it's a divine resource.
And Barbara Mahaney really gets your attention without hitting you over the head with a Chicago Cubs baseball bat. She lovingly pursues this sense of romance that she has and wants to share it with you. And you're not going to be able to stop reading this love affair with nature, the book of nature that Barbara has and that you will too. Oh, just as an example, what about the litany of astonishments? Well, we've covered flying creature monarchs and flying creature baby birds when they finally learn to fly. But here's a fact, and I'm pulling this on Barbara, having written the book some time ago, I'm asking you to remember the phenomenon of something that we kind of take for granted, dragonflies. Dragonflies' eyes.
Uh-huh.
I never thought about, I don't give a great deal of thought to dragonflies, nor do they pay attention to talk show hosts. But their eyes are something that, by the very nature of what you wrote about them, there is a kind of miraculous recognition of something that might be considered some of God's lesser creatures.
Mm.
But dragonflies of themselves are pretty darn unique. I got whiplash when I read about their eyes. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I think it's they have 224 eyes and they have no eyelids. Is that it?
They have dragonfly eyes are in the temple of their heads. They're shaped like a temple. 25,000 eyes.
Oh. Okay.
25,000 eyes. And can you imagine the industry that could be created just to make contact lenses? But those little facts and pieces of information stop me cold. I grew up so much of my life in the Midwest where we had dragonflies. But I never knew they were looking at me through at least one of 25,000 eyes. And I thank you. And I thank you for those little bits of information, the little facts in Barbara's almanac that you've included at the end of every one of these segments. I do have a question with only a few minutes left. I really do want to reserve this closing time, though, for an answer to the question that we have about those remarkable buildings on Lakeshore Drive and in Manhattan and in downtown Phoenix and San Francisco. And wherever there are gatherings of large numbers of people, there are large numbers of buildings and large numbers of birds that fly into the buildings. That's a tragedy. But there are so many natural tragedies that take place. I ask you, with 4 minutes to go, that are all yours, Barbara, what can we do about it? The buildings are not going to go away. Civilization isn't going to go away, and neither will industry. What do you ask for us to do?
Well, actually, I mean, it has been brought to the attention of architects who are, you know, the Audubon Society is behind this effort. There are various groups, you know, ecology groups, environmental groups, who are definitely putting forth efforts to cut down on the glass collisions, the bird glass collisions. If you live in a house, it can be simple as keeping the screens in your windows year round. I keep the screens in my house even in winter, because if a bird were to fly into my windows and you hear that awful, awful thud every once in a while, at least they're flying into a screen and not into glass.
But it's not just windows, Barbara. It's automobiles and it's airplanes and it's barbecue ovens. And so all I'm asking you to do in general, before people pick up the Book of Nature, and I'm not in the business of selling books, but I sure wouldn't mind if you folks picked up a copy of this one. What do you want us to do in general?
In general, to slow down long enough to pay some considerable attention to the infusion, the delicate, fragile, sometimes ferocious forces of nature all around us, and to, in ways that we might be able to construct our lives to be more hospitable to all the other creatures with whom we share this planet. And, you know, without getting into specifics about glass architecture, et cetera, I think it's realizing that our dependence on this digital world is, I mean, I'm not saying anything new here, but it's stripping us away from some essential poetries of the soul. And our soul is going to be a reflection of kind of the work and the practice we put into it. And it's a really holy thing to invite in the sacred, to pause slow enough to glance up at the stars, to consider the miracle of this moon that once upon a time was the only light shining in the night sky. Can you imagine the power that must have been imbued upon that moon?
Well, yes, and even the moon and the sun and the stars, that's covered too in the Book of Nature. Let me tell you one thing that I just was taken with this morning in the Arizona Republic, and that is a family who found a baby duck that had been orphaned, and they took it in, raised it, and one day it flew off. Mm-hmm. And then one day later, it came back with its own ducklings. And you know what? I leave you with that part of nature. The rest of it is in the Book of Nature by Barbara Mahaney. You found out about it on The God Show. And I'm Pat McMahon.